This is Authors in Focus.
Hi, I'm James Reed, a fantasy author publishing under JMV Reed. Jewels of Illumination Books 1 through 3 box set is out. Oben is a broken man who just might find redemption guarding a scholar from bandits, a criminal syndicate, and a dark necromancer. Avina is a woman haunted by guilt who has to learn if she can trust Oben. Together, they can break free of their past or be lost. You can buy or borrow Jewels of Illumination Books 1 through 3 from Amazon. Today, I'm joined by best-selling author Steven Erickson. He is the author of the award-winning Malazan Book of the Fallen and Willful Child, a Star Trek parody series.
How are you doing today, Steven?
I'm doing well, thank you. And you?
Oh, yeah, I'm doing good. Yeah, I'll be honest, I'm more than a little excited. I'm a big fan of Malazan, so it's really great to talk to you.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Cool. So anyways, I like to start my interviews off with a really dumb question or two. So are you a cat person or a dog person?
Ooh, I don't know. I guess both. At the same time, like I've had pet dogs, I've had pet cats. My wife's got some allergy issues regarding both. So we have none in the house, but there's a neighborhood cat that periodically comes into our house. And so it just shows up in the living room. So,
yeah, my last place I lived in, if I left my front door open, I would have cats just wander into my house.
Yeah.
I don't know whose cats they were.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So how long had you wanted to be an author? Since you were a kid, or is it something that just sort of you fell into?
Yeah, I guess I fell into it. I thought I was going to be a comic book illustrator. But we're going back to Stone Age time. So, you know, there was no electronic apparatus, if you will, that could facilitate doing full coloring, full everything. So I had to do everything by hand. And it just took so long to do each panel and each page that I eventually sort of dropped the illustrating side of things and just stuck with the narrative. And I started thinking about being a writer in my early 20s.
Okay.
Well, up until then, I thought I was going to be an illustrator.
Yeah. I thought I wanted to be an author like when I was a kid. And then I went to school to be a mechanical drafter and draw blueprints. So I don't know why. It's like I wanted to be an author, but I didn't do anything to pursue it for a long time.
Well, it's one of those things where it can sit on the back burner for as long as it needs to. There's nothing stopping you from becoming an author at any point in your life.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of glad I waited because it let me, you know, mature, you know, stop being like a dumb kid. And I think it's, you know, helped my writing quality anyways to let it.
Well, life experience as well.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I remember when I was in, when I went into the writing program at the University of Victoria, it was already my second degree, and I had already worked in archaeology on a number of projects and digs. And a lot of my fellow students were there, so they were younger, and this was like fresh out of high school kind of approach. And it I think a lot of them struggled, you know, they struggled to find what to write about.
Yeah.
I had too much to write about in some respects. So then I could concentrate just on the craft of writing rather than worrying about coming up with an interesting story or interesting characters. And so that's what I did. I just focused exclusively on the craft of writing.
Okay. So I've read Malazan Book of the Fallen, and I have one question. Mm-hmm. How do you break down... Yeah, no, well, I have a lot of questions. Don't get me wrong.
Okay.
My real big question is, how do you break down a plot for a Malazan book? Because they are beasts. They're some of the most complicated novels out there.
Yeah. I don't know. I had, you know, for each book, I would have sort of the final scenes in my head. And so it became a process of, well, how do I get to those scenes? Not just in terms of plot, but in terms of wrapping up a thematic exploration, in terms of delivering a kind of emotional punch that I wanted to deliver in those final scenes. And so, you know, when I have the scenes in my head and they're not yet on the page, the emotional impact is all there already. Then it just becomes a task of what do I put onto the page that's going to take the reader by the hand and at least emotionally and bring them to that same emotional level by the time we get to those final scenes. And, you know, it's in one respect, even though I consider myself a short story writer, and I structure these novels as a short story writer would. At the same time, novels have this one privilege that doesn't exist in short stories, which is the option to wander off in your narrative in unexpected directions and pull yourself back onto the main themes and main storyline at some later date. And what I found was when you wander off, you can find a lot of information that serves your theme, if not the plot. And so then it has value in, you know, just for that purpose alone. And so I would always leave enough spontaneity. I would never overmap my plot, my timeline for the novel. I would leave lots of spaces, lots of gaps. All I knew was I had an endpoint I had to reach. And how I got there was partly planned and partly spontaneous.
That's a very interesting way to look at it. Yeah, because novels definitely afford that over almost any other art form where you can just spend a lot of time, you know, exploring different, you can have a very sprawling story or it can be very focused. You can do a lot of things that you can't really do, especially non short stories, which, you know, have to be very kind of laser focused.
They do.
You got a lot of work to, you know, set up your character, your plot, your themes, and tell a story in as few words as you can.
Yeah, in some ways, you know, if I think about it, my novels are kind of a montage because specific scenes are all laser focused. But then there's just a novel in the sense is just a collection of scenes, and each one is laser focused. But sometimes the relationship between those scenes is a bit more ambiguous, a bit more ephemeral. And so in filmic terms, it is I think a kind of a montage, and then that creates, as it does in film, it creates a psychological effect. The sum is greater than, rather the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Yeah, like I'm thinking like scenes in like Dust of Dreams when you just jump around from characters in the Bone Hunters where you're going from soldier to soldier to soldier, just kind of showing us sort of their take on things and kind of giving us the impression of what the army is going through from like 20 or 25 different little snippets.
Yeah. It's like I've often described it as you're describing an invisible rock, and the only way you can do it is to slap clay on it, and that clay gives it the shape, but you never see the rock itself. You only see the clay.
Okay.
So, you know, when the Bone Hunters are marching in that book, each one of those points of view is that one more handful of clay on the invisible rock, and that rock is the army's march itself. And, you know, one could just drop in an expositional, you know, few pages to lay out that journey, but to me it's much more interesting to see it truncated versions through multiple points of view, and that sort of gives it shape.
Yeah. If handled correctly, it's you have to keep your characters distinct, which is something I think you're really good at because you have a huge amount of characters, and they always feel like none of them feel like this is just the same character with a different name.
Well, I hope not.
Yeah. So that's definitely a talent you have, and it makes the books some of the joys to read, especially when you get to come back to characters you haven't seen in like the four books or whatever.
Yeah, and I remember I would have to go back to the sections that I last wrote, you know, those characters, and read through that to pick up the voice and the mindset and all the rest. Not with all of them, because some of them were so sort of vibrant, I guess, in my mind that as soon as I went back to them, I slipped back into their voice. I think one of the reasons why I sort of chose that kind of structural approach is if I, you know, if you're writing 10 books and you're writing ultimately almost 3.25 million words, to do it all in the same voice would just be, I mean, nobody would read it. And so I needed those, that variety of voices. And so by holding really close to third person point of view, I could alter the style of the narrative based on the character. And so their diction levels would change. The things that interested them would be unique. And so that sort of kept, I hope, the interest alive. Not only for the reader, but for me as the writer as well. So that was kind of my litmus test was, you know, to actually write scenes that interested me first. Because if they didn't interest me, then they would never interest any reader. And so that's kind of the test I think that all writers are facing.
Yeah. It's kind of like I've heard some writers like, you know, look at what the market wants and write for them. And now he's like, no, I just want to write the story that I want to read, you know, mm-hmm. which what I would find to be really interesting. And that's, you know, what's, I think the main reason I am a writer, it's like I'd read books and be like, this was great, but what if they did it this way? Or, mm-hmm. you know, that's the main reason writing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what a writer does is they read stuff you have to read and then you pick up inspiration and then your imagination kicks in and you start twisting and bending it to your own interests and the things that fascinate you and the things that entertain you. And in that sense, we're constantly stealing from other writers. But then it goes through the filter of our own minds, and that's always individual. You know, a workshop exercise might be, you know, lay out a plot line for all the students in the class and say, write this out. And I've done this a couple times. And every single writer is doing something completely different with the same plot line. And I mean, that's the great thing about fiction.
Yeah. It's a wonderful thing. I mean, there's a reason humans have been telling stories since there have been humans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's something, there's a storyteller, I think, in all of us.
Just, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Just some of us just have more of the urge to take the effort to develop it, you know.
It's more like an obsession.
Yeah, definitely.
Not really an urge. It's an
obsession. Yeah. I believe that. Like I spend as much time as I can doing it.
Cool. It's
probably unhealthy in some respects, but
well, you know what? In many respects, I wouldn't argue with you. It can be hard on relationships. It can be hard on how you interact with other people. It can be hard on the way you see the world, because a lot of what writing is a kind of a questioning, an endless questioning. And then a kind of relentlessness that drives you to, you know, push a scenario or push a scene or push characters much further than, you know, one would in reality. And it has a knockback effect. It flows back into your real life. And it can be, you know, there are many tales of writers who became very self-destructive. And, you know, the argument or the idea used to be there was this romantic notion of, you know, the tortured writer. Well, no, I mean, the writer produced great work in spite of their flaws, not because of them. And
I like that. So
it's a difficult thing at times.
Yeah. And speaking of difficulty, was it challenging to switch from fantasy into your sci-fi parody of Star Trek with the Willful Child?
No, that what a relief.
Okay, yeah, I can buy that. I wrote a 270,000 word novel to cap off my epic fantasy series, mm-hmm. and I have not written a novel over like 110,000 words since, because it just felt like it would never end when I was writing that novel.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm proud of it. I love that novel, and I haven't had the years to try that again. And so
it takes a lot out of you. It really does.
Yes. Yeah, that was emotionally draining.
It is, and you put pressure on yourself as well, because you know, you're pouring everything into that one book. at any one time in your life, whatever you're writing, you're pouring everything into it. And then when you're done, you know, the doubts creep in and all the rest, and then you got to pick yourself up and do it all over again.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Willful Child is like a sort of a passion project for you.
Yeah. As a palate cleanser. Me sort of dispensing with all conventional rules of, I guess storytelling I grew up absolutely adoring the original Star Trek. I watched the originals.
Yeah.
Television. And and when I thought that I wanted to pay homage to that, I realized that would not be, you know, enough in and of itself. The Star Trek universe is delivered, I guess, into the zeitgeist, especially the original series and Kirk and all the rest.
Yeah.
All these quite simplistic notions of what that series was. And one of them, you know, that's talked about a lot is the sexism that's implicit in a lot of what the Captain Kirk was involved with, which if you watch the series is actually not the case, but it's how it's viewed now. It's how it's interpreted now. And yeah. So I wanted something where I was going to be writing a satire, not about the 1960s, but about the present. I was just going to use the 60s and the notion of a future spaceship captain whose only source of inspiration was James T. Kirk, but the modern sensibility of James T. Kirk as this rake, this lascivious captain, et cetera, et cetera, which was never there in the actual series. And so I was kind of double commenting on the sensibilities that we seem to have held on to regarding the original series, and then commenting on the fact that sexism is far from extinct in our modern age.
So when you are tackling new books, do you always like, is it theme first? Is it the climax first? Is it characters first with you?
That's theme. And quite often I'll have the title before I have anything else. And the title can be quite obscure. Thematically, so it becomes a counterpoint to the story. That's generally where it starts, and it becomes just then an issue. Well, how am I going to explore this theme, and from how many different angles can I conceive of in which to approach it?
Okay, yeah, I tend to start with character, mm-hmm. Then I find the theme as I'm writing. And it's more like discovering it, like, okay, this is why I want to tell about this character. Mm-hmm. This is sort of the theme. So it's interesting to hear how other authors approach things.
Yeah, so I think authors, there's no one way. There's you know, any way you can conceive of to motivate you to sit down to start writing a story is entirely legitimate. I mean, when I started out in writing short stories at the University of Victoria here, I went through a huge crisis because my instructor, Jack Hodgins, was one of these writers whose love of life just sort of exuded out of, you know, every sentence. And what was driving me was something a lot darker. And that sort of, it made me question the source of my inspiration as being too dark. And I remember sitting in his office once, you know, typical 24-year-old or whatever, full of angst and anguishing about this particular, you know, the dark well that was my source of inspiration. And he just looked at me and he said, well, you know, yeah, I write scenes that make people laugh, but you got to remember I laugh first. And I had to sit and think about that for a while. And that sort of put it into perspective for me. Because there is an edge to that. And he was hiding the edge well in his fiction, but it was clearly there. And then, you know, eventually just said, you've got to trust in whatever your inspiration is, whatever drives you to write, just accept it. If it's a dark place you're writing from, then write from the dark place, honor it.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, do you, you mentioned motivation. Do you have a hard time just sitting down like to write in the beginning? or did it?
No. I get. I remember talking to Steve Donaldson one time, and he described what he called life block. And I am certainly experiencing a lot of life block these days, which basically is, it's not writer's block. It's things, you know, the mundane things of living get in the way of actually writing.
Yeah.
I'm sure you know what that's like.
Yeah. It took me, I had to learn how to discipline myself to just sit down and write every day.
Yeah.
Like, it's like I wanted to do it, but then I would sit down from the keyboard and I just futz around, and then I'd be like, well, okay, I gotta go do something else. And it was really hard for me in the beginning. And now I feel weird if I can't write in a day.
Well, that's great. That's great. I mean, yeah, I get progressively, I guess it's not quite depressed. It's despondent if I'm not writing, and probably difficult to live with and all that kind of stuff. It just sort of piles up. And I know since the lockdowns and stuff, I write in cafes, and I've been unable to do that. And that's been a major struggle to this point.
Yeah, yeah. The whole throwing off your routine. You need to get in that sort of headspace to start writing.
Yeah, and you know, getting me out of the house was part of the discipline involved to going to work, to going to write.
Yeah, yeah.
And because that, you know, as we all know, that there's huge distractions, you know, in the home. And, you know, when I first started, the internet was not really a thing. You know, it was because I was in the UK, and they were a bit slow to actually sort of cotton on to actually making use of the internet in the way that people in America and Canada were doing, for example. And the reason being, they, in the UK, you were charged by the minute because you're using phone lines to go online. And so the reluctance was there. I mean, nobody wanted to, you know, get huge phone bills because they were surfing around on the internet. And it took sort of, I guess, a recognition to change all that, that actually opened things up for at least the UK sort of accessing the online space. And so when I was writing, it just wasn't there. And there was no sort of temptation. There was no Facebook. There was none of these things that you can just sort of fall onto and never come out of.
No, I fell into WoW. Like, I was 22 when WoW hit big, and I got lost. I lost my 20s to that game.
Exactly. And I wasn't fanatic about, I mean, my son's pretty fanatic about gaming, but there were a lot of games I liked.
Yeah.
But I didn't, because I was writing off a laptop where I had loaded no games. you know, when I go out to work, there's no option there.
Yeah.
And often I would turn off, you know, mind you, when we first started, there was no Wi-Fi. You had to, I can't remember how they did it back then. Anyways, I just wasn't online when I went out to work.
You had long wires that ran across your house.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to live in the basement of the house me and my friends rented, and we had to like run that line outside the house and through windows so I could get internet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was great. It was just, it sort of reinforced the discipline needed to actually sit and write. And I suspect, you know, these days it's a lot harder for writers to be able to sort of shut all those windows. I mean, windows in every sense, and just concentrate on what they're, you know, what they want to be doing, which is writing.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely plenty of memes about it. So
yeah,
must be a truth behind that.
I would think so.
So I have a question. What is it like working with Ian Cameron Esselmutz, you know, and creating your world together?
Well, it doesn't feel like work, for one thing.
Oh, that's good.
And we tend to write our own works without sort of, occasionally we'll email back and forth just to get some clarification on, you know, particular characters, what you got planned for them, if anything. And we fell into the habit very early on of creating characters and leaving them for the other author to pick up if they so choose. And that was a lot of fun because one could never know, you know, I could never know which characters Cam would pick up and run with. And we'd never sent each other manuscripts prior to the publications. So I'd be, you know, I'd be a newbie reader to his novels just as any other reader would be. And that made it a lot more entertaining, a lot more fun.
That does. Yeah. So because there's the one thing that Malazan is so different from anything else. It really does feel like the world exists beyond your plot. The main story, like, because like characters come and go, you have plot lines you set up that continue on in, you know, Ezelman's books, or, you know, it's just that the world exists and there's more going on than just, you know, the crippled god and what he's up to.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And,
that's, I think, one of the things that people like about the series. I know it's one of the things I like. It's, I have a hard time describing it to friends, like what makes Malazan so much different from any other like fantasy out there. And it's just, I think, really the fact that this world feels very much alive and not just at the service of one overarching plot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have more stories than we have, you know, years left to write. And I think we kind of like that because it leaves, it's like a library that, you know, you can go in and pluck two or three volumes off and wander off into a corner and concoct a novel based on those two or three books, those references. But you got the rest of the library surrounding you, and it's all there. It's all potential. And I mean, in a sense, we're slowly working through it, but we'll never be able to, you know, lay out all the stories that we've gained, that we've experienced, and the backstories also that we always made sort of implicit, occasionally explicit in our gaming. So it's all sitting there. I mean, we had a whole campaign that dropped us back into the Bronze Age of the main continent of the Malazan Empire.
Okay.
And that gaming campaign basically elucidated the foundational aspects that were hidden in the, you know, in the main timeline, and sort of gave reasons for why things were as they were. And that was a lot of fun. And we, of course, will never write it, but it's the backstory that we have now. And so we can use it and we can rely upon it.
Yeah, that's you can create so much backstory for your world, and like barely any of it should appear in the books.
Yep, agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed.
I definitely, my first Epic Fantasy series, I learned that lesson. I put a lot of effort into it, and some of it was, I liked that I had some of it, but I think I spent effort in places that didn't matter at all. And
I wouldn't say they didn't matter. They clearly mattered, but
yeah,
it mattered more for you than for the story.
Yeah, it mattered It mattered absolutely nothing for the story. But it helped me, let me like envision the world and how it evolved from through its various epochs of, you know, rise of empires and collapse and rise again, and until we got to the current, you know, status of the world and how it kind of fell out in that way. But yeah,
exactly. And of course that's what grounds you as the writer in that world. So it has to be more familiar to you than to anyone else. And then if it's not, then you got to backtrack. You got to start building some history.
I like using short stories for that. I really suck at just sitting down and like making things. So if I can write like a short story that will do it for me, then even if I don't, even if I never publish it, like it just, I don't know. It, my brain works better. Like, oh, I have, like, I'm not just building this backstory about some country for nothing. I'm doing it for a story that, like, it'll matter, I guess. Yeah. And so my brain goes like, oh, this is important and will let me focus.
Yeah. And I mean, that story can show up in various versions, right? It can be within, if it's a story that's told within the fictional world you created, it can be part of epic poetry within that world. It can be part of the bardic tradition.
Yeah.
So it's all there. It's all there for you to use for sure.
Oh yeah. I definitely use it. They're even like the foundations for novels and stuff.
Yeah.
They're not exactly in canon because I like, when you, I don't know, there's like I create something for a short story and it's good, but like it doesn't work for a novel. I need it maybe to be more complicated, like a magic system, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like, because I have like a whole series that's based off a short story, and like I had to switch the whole kind of religion around that's in it, because I felt it was too similar to other religions in the world, and I wanted to stand out more, so I kind of had to tweak it. But the concepts and the ideas and the characters are all there. And so it's just, you know, you just got to, if you read it, and people have read it and they're just like, yeah, you just got to ignore this little, like this little inconsistency with the religion. Maybe one day I'll fix it.
But. Yeah. And, you know, the one out for that is if you've tied it close to a point of view, you know, you can pick 50 people, all of the same religion, and they'll all have a different interpretation of that religion.
Oh yeah. That's I love doing that. I love bringing cultures together and having them go like, that's super weird that you guys do this. And people are like, why? I mean, it makes sense to me. You know, I don't know. It's just, I think it's fun just taking people from different backgrounds and just throwing them together and seeing how they react with each other.
Absolutely. And it's, if you think about it, it's where all fictional storytelling conflict comes from, which is a clash of worldviews. And that can be between two characters or between two nations or, between two leaders of two separate nations. It can be, you know, it's going on everywhere. You can look around in our world and see nothing but a clash of worldviews.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, that's where the heart of the human condition will be found. So it's a great thing to explore.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you tackle creating your characters? Like, do you think about like the character needs to fit a theme or?
No. Okay. It's weird. I come up with their character names, and so I create, you know, if I've got a squad, I just come up with six names. And then I look at the names, and I kind of attach something to them. And it's often not in a direct sense. Quite often names are ironic. At least my name conventions can be quite often ironic. So that name just sort of sits there, and then I'll drop into that particular point of view. And in the first few scenes, I'll get a sense of where this character is coming from. And then I'll just run with it and keep pushing the.
So you're relying a lot on like your intuition with.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. That's your intuition is a funny thing when it like smacks you in the head and derails your story, because you know your subconscious, like at least my subconscious, I'm always like realizing I'm putting together pieces that I didn't realize I was doing, and suddenly it just like a pattern had formed in my story that I didn't even aware I was putting into it, or I just like my characters will just tell me like, hey, you're doing something dumb here.
My next book out, I created a character and my initial thought was she has no sense of humor. So I was going to run with that as a point of view. But it didn't take long before I realized that this is a character who's on the spectrum. And that got me really excited, because then that gave me sort of, okay, now I know exactly where this, you know, how to write this character and where this character is going and how that character engages with other characters and with the world around them.
Yeah, and it's fun when you hit on that little bit of their backstory, right?
That absolutely just
opens her up, or him, or whatever them, whatever character it is.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the fun of writing.
It is, and I just had great fun writing her as a character.
So what is your next book coming out?
I think it's in August, at least in.
Yeah. I'm just so lost. I'm sure like people listening to this have better. I'm so lost in like my own writing that I have a hard time keeping up on what's coming out anymore.
Well, and I don't know the specific dates either, because, you know, they get bounced around all the time. I know people ask me and I just say, I don't know, you know, go to the publisher's site.
So I just thought, what is the book actually? That's what I'm kind of, I didn't even know you had a book coming out this year.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's a return to, the Malazan universe 10 years after the events of the Crippled God.
Oh yeah.
And it's the first book of a trilogy.
Is it the Carso Olong trilogy?
Yeah.
Awesome.
The Witness trilogy.
He was reading his story in book 4 was like really hard to get through at first until and not even to realize who the character was until like you get like what 100 200 pages into that book. Mm-hmm. But like he really grew on me as a character. Just seeing his character arc is a fantastic one.
It's an extensive one, that's for sure.
He goes, I mean, just his change, his growth, his maturity. Like he went from a boy playing at being a man, right? At you know what he thinks a man should be, to actually becoming that. And it's a really great story arc. And so and he has a really great view on things. So I'm kind of interested to see where he goes.
Yeah. I mean, ironically, he doesn't even show up in this first book. It's more, it's his legacy that
all right.
I had to write it.
I'm not surprised by that. Like you're all right. Yeah. So, well, that's something to look forward to.
Yeah. It's called The God Is Not Willing.
Okay. Yeah. I had heard that you were working on his, that was going to be the next thing. I think I heard that a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And like I said, I'm lucky if I get to read more than like 30 minutes in a day or something. So
it's hard. And as a writer, it's, you know,
yeah, it's like you need to read, but then you also have to do other stuff. You have to write. And I'm indie, so I have to like market and I have to deal with cover artists and
that's a lot of work.
Yeah. But like, you know, if you can find the good people, it's a big help. So I think I've kind of got through all the questions I wanted. So do you have any advice for like newer aspiring authors?
Only the advice I would always give, which is finish what you start. It's very easy to get excited about something and, you know, the first section just rips by on the keyboard. And then it starts getting harder. And that's the learning point.
Everything up
and you already know how to do, which is why it went so fast. But the learning point is when it starts getting hard and you start.
Right, the middle of it, like when you're not, you want to this awesome ending, and you know you have this really great beginning, and there's this part in the middle you got to write.
Yes, yeah, and it's just it's grinding your way through it. So that I mean, you know, when I've taught workshops, I see it quite often. People that abandon a project by the third, you know, rewrite stage, in order to write something new, because there's something very seductive in that like.
That was one of the things that held me back when I was a teenager. I was ADD, so I was like, oh, I have a new idea. Well, we'll just throw this project away and just start this next one and write like four or five chapters and go like, oh no, I have another idea. Let's do this one. Yeah, I didn't.
Yeah.
There was a while when I thought I couldn't even finish a novel. So finishing a novel was a really great achievement.
Yeah, finishing is the most. I mean, the first novel you finish, man, that just. Yeah, it snaps so many chains, you know, that's holding you back because now you know you can do it.
Yeah.
And you can ride on that faith for, you know, for the next 20 years.
And the next hurdle is sharing it with someone.
Yeah. I mean, because I sort of went through the workshops, undergraduate and the master's stuff, that was sort of never a concern. And I'm often surprised that when, you know, people write and then put their story on the shelf and nobody sees it. I mean, to me, the initial premise has to be you're communicating. And in order to communicate, you need at least two people.
Yeah.
So there's got to be an audience out there somewhere that you're writing to and writing for. And yeah, it can be, you know, we tend to sort of lay our souls bare when we create something. And so you can feel very vulnerable. And I guess that's where workshops come in, because you acquire a fairly thick skin, or you don't make it. It's one or the other. And I think one needs that sense of objectivity to their creative projects, so that when you go back to them, you can have that clinical, detached editorial eye and read it fresh.
Great advice. Thanks. It was really great talking with you, Stephen.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time out.
Oh, no problem. No problem.
You have yourself a good day.
Yeah, you too. Let's hope it doesn't rain in Tacoma.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be inside all day, so I don't care.
Fair enough.
All right. Have a good one.
Yep.
This has been Authors in Focus. You can find my fantasy novels on Amazon. Follow news of my writing at my blog, jmd-read.com, and follow me on Twitter at jmdread. You can also join my reader group on Facebook, Fantastical Worlds of the Imagination. You can find more episodes of the podcast at fantasy-focus.com and wherever your favorite podcast is hosted.